This is a Defocus Media production.
This podcast was made possible with the financial support from Sun Pharma Canada, Inc. Defocus Media and the 2020 podcast have had full editorial control over the content shared in this podcast. Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the 2020 podcast, Canada's number one optometry podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me here to learn and to grow. I am truly grateful for all the time that you spend with me, and I'm really grateful for all of the shares and the likes and the follows and everything everyone has done to support the podcast. Thank you so very much for doing that and for continuing to do that. As always, I try to bring on guests that I think will be valuable for us here in the eye care industry to learn from and that will help us to grow and to expand our horizons. And Dr. Alfonso Iovieno is definitely one of those people who's going to help us learn a lot. Let me do a quick introduction, and then we're going to talk to Dr. Iovieno a little bit about who he is as well. But Dr. Alfonso Iovieno currently works as a clinical associate professor at the University of British Columbia. He's based right here in Vancouver. Dr. Iovieno obtained his medical degree and completed his ophthalmology residency at the University Campus Biomedico in Rome, Italy, and then subspecialized in cornea, external disease, ocular surface, and complex anterior segment surgery during his three-year fellowship training at the University of Toronto and Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. Dr. Iovieno also completed his PhD in ocular microbiology, immunology between the University Campus Biomedico, and the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute in Miami. Those are some big name institutions, some big name academic institutions and training institutions that I think we're all very aware of. The last thing I want to mention before we get into it is Dr. Iovieno, true to his Italian background, is an avid soccer fan, and I'm going to start the conversation there. But first, thank you, Dr. Iovieno, for joining me on the 2020 podcast.
Thank you very much, Herbier. Thanks for the invitation. I'm really glad to be here with you guys. The only thing I wanted to add to my background is that I like to travel a lot, as you know, the last part of the background said, hence, you know, my experiences in many countries, right? So,
absolutely. And I think that we could probably have an entire podcast just talking about soccer and traveling. Let's just touch on the soccer thing just for a second, because I'm a pretty big football fan myself.
All right.
What do you follow? Do you follow Italian soccer, English soccer? Who's your team?
No, I follow Italian soccer, and I'm a Southern Italian. So my hometown is in the outskirts of Naples. So I follow Napoli. That's off to a pretty exciting start of the season this year. Oh, so, you know, we're having a lot of fun.
That's excellent. Napoli is definitely a historic team, has had some good runs and had some big players in the past. Maradona, if I'm not mistaken, back in the
day. There you go. Yeah.
Definitely. So, good. Great. That's great. Well, thank you. Thanks again for joining me. The conversation that we want to have today is around dry eye, and more specifically, the collaboration between optometry and ophthalmology in the treatment of dry eye. I think this is a topic that gets talked about a lot, kind of in meetings and just in sort of casual conversations, but, you know, doesn't really get spoken about in public like this as much as it should. I really think that there's so much opportunity for us to elevate both professions and, more importantly, the patient experience and patient outcomes by collaborating and you know, elevating that collaboration. So thanks for taking the time to have this conversation.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's start with, you know, the various forms of dry eye. You know, dry eye, that one term kind of sometimes kind of pigeonholes the condition. I feel like we just say dry eye, and a patient's mind, even doctor's mind, will kind of go to one specific set of symptoms. But we know that it's actually a very broad range of symptoms and diagnoses and ocular signs that we could be looking at. I wonder if you can, maybe in your opinion, break it down into some of the few categories of the types of dry eye that you're seeing, and then we can go into a bit of the diagnosis aspect of it too.
Yeah, so it's definitely a good chunk of the patients that we see as optometrists and ophthalmologists are affected by this condition, either primarily or, you know, as a kind of like a secondary add-on to their primary sort of eye pathology, right? So academically, you know, dry eye patients, as you all know, used to be, you know, divided in hyposecretive, evaporative, and the sort of neuropathic ocular pain. I think a lot of this black and white distinction right now has blurred very much, right? So we tend to sort of see these patients, diagnose them with their condition, and kind of like focus on their signs and their symptoms, and try to, based on their signs and symptoms, assign them to specific treatment. So it's a whole sort of like spectrum of dry eye, for which, as you know, there are many treatments available. But, you know, the general sort of, umbrella of dry eye right now doesn't tend to be divided very much between different categories. Having said that, you know, there are the patients that suffers from dry eye as a consequence of autoimmune disease. They're very peculiar, and they will probably be more responsive to certain kinds of treatment versus the dry eye that tends to happen, you know, in patients after refractive surgery, or the form of dry eye that tends to affect mostly postmenopausal women. They will all be, have some specific features that are more likely to respond to some treatments in particular.
Yeah, well, if we could dive into that a little bit more, you know, if somebody who has a particularly maybe an autoimmune condition, a Sjogren's or something like that, if we were to kind of make a bit of a distinction between some of these particular forms of in the postmenopausal women, would there be different signs that you would encourage optometrists to be looking for, you know, somebody who maybe doesn't practice dry eye in depth, but ways that we can maybe see clues that we would know to go down a certain path?
Sure. So just for example, to take those categories into account, right? I think a good chunk of my dry eye patients, or dry eye patients in my practice, come from that autoimmune background. And that's because of my collaboration with dermatology or with rheumatology for the care of, let's say, cicatrizing conjunctivitis or other complex anterior segment diseases. Now, those patients have, you know, oftentimes a very severe form of dry eye, but it's also a very quote-unquote rewarding form of dry eye to treat as a doctor, because they're the ones that would really respond to medications, both, you know, from the point of view of signs and of symptoms. So those are the patients where I can confidently say that I can cure them, although a cure is not really sort of a word for a chronic condition, but I can make them feel a lot better. So they will present, and they will have they will be extremely light sensitive, they will have foreign body sensation, and they will, you know, invariably covered in punctate erosions involving the cornea and the conjunctiva. And they are the ones that, you know, as I said, standard treatments such as, lubricating agents would not really, you know, touch them very much. They will need to pull out the big guns almost from the get-go, with the understanding that, you know, the response in their case would be very prompt and very satisfactory, right? On the opposite end of the spectrum, there would be, for example, the neuropathic ocular pains patients, for example, the ones that develop this condition following refractive surgery. Their signs would be, you know, very mild, if not absent at all. But on the other hand, they would have very sort of debilitating symptoms. And the treatment approach for them, it's in a way, you know, collateral. It's not, we don't have any, you know, etiological agent that we can give to them and know that they will respond exactly to that. So we try to optimize their surface as much as possible, and we achieve a certain degree of success, you know, in treating them, or at least in making their symptoms better.
That's wonderful. I want to go back to the big guns in just a second, but talking about that neuropathic pain, you know, I think three of the most hated words when put together for anybody who treats ocular surface is pain without stain, right? It's like, how do we fix this? So do you have any thoughts on, you know, why do we get this kind of neuropathic pain, and how might a primary care, optometrist approach that when they have a patient in that setting?
Yeah, I wish I had a more precise answer for you, really. If I knew exactly what was going on, I'll be probably, you know, way richer than I am at this point in time. But the truth of the matter is that there's a lot of science going on, on that extent, right? There are centers of excellence scattered throughout our country and United States where active research is ongoing. There's definitely something happening at the level of, the peripheral nerves of the cornea, either in the form of development of neuromas, aberrant regeneration. Maybe there's something at the level of neurotransmitters level, you know, on the ocular surface. So once we'll have a better understanding of this, we'll have also better ways of somehow, you know, interventionist or ophthalmologists that would have to deal with this kind of patients. has on its hands the armamentarium for dry eye, which includes the anti-inflammatory medications. Moving on, in those patients more frequently than others to the use, for example, of autologous serum, the presence of neuropathic neurotrophic growth factors in autologous serum seems to be, one of the reasons why that treatment is justified in patients with neuropathic ocular pain, to the use, for example, of scleral lenses, which, as I tell my patients, it's like you're sticking your head in a fishbowl, right? So, and that's a way of kind of like suppressing the activity of those aberrant nerves on the surface of the eye, right? I know that people are venturing into, low-dose naltrexone, amitriptyline, all the way to, for example, diluted topical anesthetics, very diluted topical anesthetics, or even, cannabinoids for the treatment of those conditions. And, there's such a tremendous momentum of research and need from our patients for new treatments that I'm sure something, more new and possibly groundbreaking will come up in the next few years.
Yeah, and all of those things that you mentioned, the low dose anesthetics, the cannabinoids and all those others, nortriptylines, have those shown some potential like positive effects, or is it all kind of anecdotal at this point?
No, they have. I think there's not an abundance of literature on this, but there is some, right? I haven't ventured into, the more sort of experimental treatments myself, but I do work in conjunction with some neuro-ophthalmologists who are more versed in the use of those type of medications. And we have put some of those patients on gabapentin, amitriptyline, even the topiramate or the low dose naltrexone. Obviously, these are systemic medications. The side effects profile from these medications is can be quite significant at times, limits the compliance of the patient. But sometimes the motivation is just so strong that if patients do notice some improvement in their symptoms with systemic medications, even if the improvement is not massive, they will still be very tempted to go for that, right? So if I had to pin it down to a percentage, I would say probably in about 50% of the patients, we've been able to achieve some success.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah, I can tell definitely as I've ventured myself more into the space of dry eye and treating it, the more of these patients that walk through the door, you realize how much it really affects their lifestyle. Quality of life actually is more importantly what I want to get at. You think of it initially as just sort of you get a little dryness and irritation, but there are patients who walk in and just say, I can't take it anymore. It affects every aspect of my life. And it's really difficult to have that conversation, especially when you have something like this where we don't have any obvious treatment modalities for it. But it's good to know that at least there's some bright spots and some opportunities to help those patients. Now, I think you touched on it, but often those patients will see some of them, at least to some degree, having this type of neuropathic symptoms after they've had some sort of refractive surgery, whether it's cataract or laser surgery. Is that just a well-documented thing? Or again, is that sort of anecdotal as well?
No, I think honestly, there's enough evidence out there to know that, and this is what I tell my patients, that regardless of the type of surgery they're going to have, done to the surface of their eyes, their dry eye will get worse. So if they do have dry eye, what I tell them, you're looking into at least a few months of worsening of your dry eye condition, which will then, with a little bit of work, return to what it was before. It will not be, ameliorated by the surgery, and it will not be worsened by that. The only exception to maybe this spiel would be patients that are undergoing refractive surgery. So for the refractive surgery bit, honestly, the effect on, either LASIK or PRK on the corneal nerve plexus is such that there is a subset of patients, obviously not the majority of them, that will experience, persistent worsening of dry eye symptoms or even de novo dry eye, right? Again, a lot of effort, given the popularity of refractive surgery procedure, right? A lot of people are trying to work out why this is happening or are trying to work out, what can be done to prevent that or treat it more effectively. All we have right now is that obviously we don't want to do any procedures in any patient whose ocular surface has not been optimized. Mm-hmm. And that comes from many sort of points of view. Even something as simple as an intraocular lens calculation can be sometimes completely thrown off by an uneven tear fill, right? So every patient that would approach any corneal procedure should have their dry eye and ocular surface optimized by means of using topical lubricants if they were not using them before. Some surgeons advocate the introduction very early on of, you know, cyclosporin or lifitegrast, right, in patients, you know, before the advent of a surgical procedure. So these are all viable options, but definitely this is not something that that should be sort of overlooked, because the outcomes for those patients and their satisfaction will be very dependent on that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You're already segueing into the next topic that I wanted to discuss with you. But before I get into that, because I did really want to dig into that, you know, the optimizing the ocular surface for refractive surgery. I think that's a topic that many ODs would like to kind of, if not learn about, then at least sort of have confirmed, you know, confirm their belief that this is something they should be promoting to their patients before they get refractive surgery. But going back to the big guns, you mentioned in the beginning of the conversation, certain conditions, you bring up the big guns right off the top. And I'm curious to know what those big guns are and kind of what order you would rank them as far as like first level, second level, and so on.
Yeah. So, you know, when it comes to down to patients that have like autoimmune diseases, but, you know, I guess this could be translated to any dry eye patient. One of the, you know, big guns in my book is autologous serum or PRP, right? And it's not a big gun in the sense that there are, you know, any potential side effects to be expected, you know, from the patient's point of view. But it does, you know, represent a monthly significant expense, you know, on the patient side. So the benefit that the patient perceives from that should be at least at par, you know, with the financial burden, right? Now, autologous serum or PRP are, in my book, probably the best treatment for the autoimmune dry eye that we have available. Patients with autoimmune dry eye are very responsive to that. There is the, you know, potential controversy of, you know, in particular, the ones that are going through very significant bouts of inflammation, of using their own blood, which may contain sort of pro-inflammatory cytokines on their own eyes. But, you know, we don't have any other way around this, at least in our neck of the woods. There's no blood bank to supply these patients. But that's definitely, you know, one of the medications that the patient welcomes with a little bit of skepticism at first. I'm like, you want my own blood to be turned into an eye drop, yeah, right? It sounds like they're looking at you as some sort of medieval medicine man, but you know, when they do see the benefit of that, they'll definitely appreciate.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the more, from my perspective, and it was exciting sort of aspects of treating dry eyes. You know, using PRP, I know it's used in other medical specialties in other areas to treat different conditions. So it's nice to see that there's some benefits on the ocular surface as well. Do you do that in your own office, or how does a patient have that done?
So here in Vancouver, there's a facility where the blood is processed. The facility only produces autologous serum, not PRP, at least the one that I've been, you know, sending patients to. This is, you know, in a way a reflection of the practices of modern medicine. I haven't been doing this job for that long, but, you know, in my sort of 15 years as a cornea specialist, I remember in the early days, we were just, you know, essentially doing that in-house in ways that may not have been that standardized in that sense. But honestly, I guess, you know, the risk that that there is in producing this kind of product, aside from, you know, the obvious contamination, is not particularly high, right? But, you know, in presence of a dedicated facility here, I think we you know, definitely appreciate them doing this for us.
Right. Definitely elevates the standard and kind of the standardization, if you will, of that whole process. Could you, if you wouldn't mind, defining the difference between autologous serum and PRP?
So with PRP, the idea is to use a substance inside PRP, calcium gluconate, that will break the platelet cell wall and will get out of the platelets some, you know, factors, for example, platelet-derived growth factors that have been shown to enhance, in a way, the activity of autologous serum. Now, whether one product is superior to the other or blatantly superior to the other, I think the jury's still out, right? But, you know, honestly, having access to either one of them is definitely, you know, a very valuable asset for treatment of dry eye patients.
Well, that's perfect. Thank you for defining the difference there between those two and why PRP potentially may be more valuable. We had, before I'd taken you back to that question, started to talk about optimizing the ocular surface for refractive surgery. And as I was mentioning, I know that I do this, and I know I've spoken to multiple colleagues that are starting to do this, where we're, when a patient is looking to get cataract surgery or laser surgery, we talk to them about the importance of optimizing the tear film and the ocular surface, and how that, in theory, and hopefully in practice, you'll confirm that it can help to improve the readings that you get before surgery, the outcomes that patients will have after surgery. Is that generally what you have seen?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. In particular, for example, in reference to cataract surgery, when we're using premium IOLs, where we have to be, the level of precision where our calculation has to be, you know, held to higher standards compared to monofocal lenses, any interference with measurements of astigmatism and all the other preoperative measurements that we do before cataract surgery will translate into suboptimal outcomes from the vision standpoint, right? So it's particularly important for them. So I don't think that, you know, to patients preoperatively, necessarily a different sort of like treatment approach would apply than any, you know, dry eye patients that comes to a clinic who's not going to have any eye surgery done. So the same thing that I would use for any other eye patient, I would use them, you know, for these patients. But I mean, it's important to consider that those treatments have to be put in place a number of weeks and sometimes even months before the patient can undergo a successful surgical procedure.
Gotcha. Well, it's good, again, to hear from you, from a surgeon, from somebody who's an expert in the field, to have that confirmation of the importance of doing that. Hopefully that'll encourage some of my colleagues to kind of have that conversation a bit more preemptively, you know, before a patient goes in for consultations and so on. Again, not necessarily treating them differently than any other dry eye patient, like you mentioned, but just making sure the patient's aware of the importance of treating that dry eye. So let's say we have a patient like that in front of, in your exam chair, who has dry eye, and you mentioned this already, you know, that surgeons and doctors are preemptively getting started in certain treatments. What types of treatments would you be offering this patient? I guess it'll depend on the type of dry eye they have, but what would you be suggesting to them weeks or months before their surgery?
Yeah, so, I mean, if the patient has any component of meibomian gland involvement, either a meibomian gland dysfunction, posterior blepharitis or anterior blepharitis, so care of blepharitis, you know, takes precedence, right? So the patient will be on warm compresses, can, depending on the severity of the blepharitis, can consider the use of oral doxycycline, can consider, you know, the use of any of the available devices for optimization of meibomian gland health, right? Then when it comes to the surface itself, if there's a reduced tear meniscus, if there are punctate erosions present, those patients will be on tear substitutes. I have, generally speaking, a very low threshold of introducing anti-inflammatory treatments. And that I think is a point that I wanna get through, because of the cost of such treatments, or because of the, you know, medicinal in a way nature of them. Sometimes we hold back on the use of, you know, cyclosporin or lifitegrast more than we should, and we leave those type of drugs for patients who are, you know, more severe in our books. I think the early introduction of this type of medication goes a long way, right? I think a lot of the patients who are, you know, the highest responders to them are not the ones that necessarily present with a ghastly ocular surface, right? But they're the ones where, you know, they have a mild to moderate dry eye, you know, we know that the window of intervention of those drugs is going to be better on them, and that's based on the literature we have available, right? Now, whether, you know, patients before surgery will need other types of intervention is obviously based on their severity. In the vast majority of patients, I think this will be sufficient. Then, you know, whether we move on to the use of punctum plugs or punctal occlusion of sort, or you know, autologous serum or things like that, then that will be dependent on severity.
Right. I think that's a really important point that you brought up there about the introduction of some of these pharmaceuticals early on. I'm definitely in the past have been guilty of that. You know, I will save the cyclosporin as a third or fourth thing after I've tried a few other things. But of course you're going to, and then I would say, well, it's not as effective as I thought it should be. But then I'm also obviously reserving it for the more complicated cases where maybe I should be introducing it a little earlier on. So would you think it's like a first line, you know, therapy or second, like, you know, for that person who seems to need it, would you be introducing it right off the top? Like, here's your lubricants plus here's your cyclosporin.
Yeah. So honestly, after I would give the patient probably no longer than a couple of weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, to see if they receive any benefit from the treatment with, you know, artificial tears, preserved or preservative-free, depending on, you know, what's the frequency of use and their, you know, eyelid hygiene optimization. But if they don't respond, I'll introduce it right away. We've also, you know, didn't mention as, and that's often the case of sort of like not really paying enough attention to that. At stage zero, let's say, of dry eye treatment, which is the environmental modifications. Mm-hmm. I think we've all been surprised, you know, when we heard from patients, oh, you know, I sleep with a fan directly onto, you know, my face or just above the bedroom, or, you know, any other things that if sort of detected and modified will make a very significant impact on this patient's quality of life, right? And will facilitate any further sort of medical or non-medical intervention that we plan for this patient's dry eye. So digging a little bit into their personal history and their habits, I think it's also something that goes a long way.
Absolutely. Actually, very important. And you're right, gets overlooked a little too much, the environmental factors. I've had so many patients will tell me they'll go on vacation to some tropical destination, right? They go to Jamaica or something. And they'll come back and say, wow, for 2 weeks, my eyes felt amazing. Well, let's think about, you know, you being in a warm, humid climate and not staring at a computer screen all day and all the factors that you, you know, eliminated for those 2 weeks. Yeah. You know, how valuable that can be just trying to address those day to day.
Yeah, I'm a little bit contact lens intolerant myself. I don't wear contact lenses very often, but, you know, when I do, I use daily disposables and I don't tolerate them very well. But I remember when I was living in Miami, for example, you mentioned before, you know, when I was at Bascom Palmer Eye Institute, I thought that, you know, how is it possible that anybody over here has any dry eye?
It's like, it's true. So it's humid. It's humid down there. So getting back to then the various treatment modalities, you touched on the fact that there's, you know, various technologies. Dry eye as a, you know, has kind of been the target of a lot of new technology and technological advancement and really a growing specialty in eye care. You know, radio frequency, IPL, low light, low level light therapy, all these different technologies out there. Have you had much hands-on experience yourself with these technologies?
Not very much. The only one that I have a little bit of hands-on experience is IPL, and that's that was a few years ago. Anyways, with the newer technology, I haven't had a chance to test them out myself. This is a reflection of I think, you know, how much interest there is towards dry eye research, how much, you know, there's patients asks us for additional treatments and more effective treatments than what we have available. On a lot of this newer technology, I would say there isn't enough of a scientific background or pedigree to really come up with you know, precise guidelines and conclusions, right? But I do look at all these efforts very favorably, right? So I think that out of this, something, you know, very substantial will come up. And then again, you know, one of the mistakes is to think that we're going to find the holy grail, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to find, you know, the one device or the one drop that we give to everybody and solve everybody's problem. That's not true for many chronic diseases we treat, hypertension, diabetes. Why would it be the same for dry eye, right? Yeah. So we will need to approach this in a multimodal way. And if technology helps us in that sense, very, very positive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's another very good point, is not to think that there's any silver bullet. You know, as the what I forgot to mention in your introduction is that you're an ambassador for TFOS, for the Tear Film and Ocular Surface Society, and the DEWS 2 report kind of is that the holy grail or Bible of the, you know, of dry eye definitions and whatnot. But in that definition, it says it's a multifactorial disease. We have to always treat it that way and try to address the various factors that may be involved, right? But I agree with you. There's still a lot to be learned and understood about these various technologies and their application. But again, like you said, I think it's a very positive sign that there's a lot of energy being put into this area where we might be able to come up with new solutions to help our patients. So hopefully they'll become, at some point, you know, officialized and studied well enough that we can be on here again next time talking about how all of these can be used to help our patients.
Oh, definitely.
So the one of the core topics, as I mentioned off the top, you know, to talk about dry eye, but more importantly and more specifically, we wanted to talk about the collaboration between ophthalmology and optometry, and the opportunity that we have here to really improve our patient outcomes with this collaboration. So I wanted to dig into that just in general. You know, I'm going to give it to you as a very open question. What are your thoughts on that? And then we'll kind of dig in a little bit more about how we can improve that collaboration.
Yeah, so I don't know if, you know, the situation that we have here in British Columbia is representative of the rest of Canada. But I have to say that dry eye is one of the areas in ophthalmology and in the anterior segment in specifically where I do see, you know, the fruits and the benefits of a very sort of, you know, respectful and effective collaboration between optometry and ophthalmology, right? So the thing is, the incidence of this disease is such that the mass of patients that need, you know, treatment for dry eye will be overwhelming for almost every health system, I would say, right? So having, you know, more than one health professional dealing with this kind of patients is definitely, you know, a winning move, right? As we've been saying for the last half an hour, a lot of these patients will need many treatments. We'll need a multimodal approach. Now, oftentimes, you know, our time is restricted, right? Our clinics are busy. There's patients, you know, that need many attention from many points of view. And, you know, the dry eye patients do require a certain amount of time and a certain level of expertise, right? So I have to say, you know, the optometry community has been at the forefront of dry eye science. You know, at least in British Columbia, every optometrist I've interacted with has been, you know, definitely very up to date and very sort of, you know, versed and predisposed towards the treatment of these patients, right? So, you know, collaborating on this as collaborating in, you know, the care of post-surgical patients, the refractive standpoint, I think is one of the, you know, very many elements where the collaboration really between optometrists and ophthalmologists can flourish.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that regard, if this might be a tough one, but how do you see that, you know, coming to fruition? I know you mentioned, of course, we understand with ophthalmology, your time with patients is quite brief. You're very busy, lots of patients coming through. And there is a lot of handholding required with dry eye patients. We're all very familiar with that. As you know, it can be quite a challenging disease or, you know, condition to treat. But where do you see that overlap happening? So if you could give me sort of an example of a patient where you think both ophthalmology and optometry could work on and collaborate with.
So, for example, one of the situations that you mentioned before, so preparing patients for surgery, either cataract or refractive surgery, is definitely one of them, right? Mm. The optometrist will oftentimes be the port of entry of a patient with a cataract or a patient that's interested in refractive surgery. So putting in place, in an optometry clinic, the perioperative treatment that will then, you know, influence good measurements on our end, good outcomes of our surgery is definitely, you know, one possibility. Then, you know, among optometrists and ophthalmologists, there is obviously, you know, personal interest or research interest. So the fact that some optometrists, at least in our community, have put together, you know, dry eye clinics where they have acquired the latest, you know, devices, they're able to offer a sort of comprehensive approach to these patients. You know, from any point of view, you know, from macological, you know, with the technology, either at the diagnosis or at the treatment, you know, point, I think it's something that has to be recognized, right? Whoever has, in that sense, you know, the willingness and the desire to explore, you know, this type of field and provide the standard of care to patients, I think has to be somehow recognized by the community, right? So because for those patients, again, you know, telling them that we have artificial tears here, and maybe if you're bad enough, you can go and get some cyclosporine in there, and then, you know, if that hasn't worked, well, that's about it. You got to live with it, and that's the end of the road. I don't think it's standard of practice, you know, in this day and age. We have to be able to offer, you know, more than one modality of treatment, as you mentioned before. So whoever ophthalmologist or optometrist would want to dwell into that and offer the whole range of treatments to patients, I think definitely needs to be recognized.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in my mind anyways, I think for a long time that relationship, optometry and ophthalmology has seemed somewhat one way, and I'm not trying to put it on a negative spin on it, but in general, we're referring to ophthalmologists for treatment and then the patient will come back to us. But to have it a little more open and two-way where, you know, perhaps an ophthalmologist sees the opportunity for certain treatment modality and has the patient come in to see the optometrist who's developed that dry eye clinic, and the patient kind of has an open access to both, that seems like a nice, maybe somewhat of an ideal scenario. You know, to be able to create that would be very nice.
Absolutely.
What else, you know, any suggestions in your mind as to how we can maybe better this collaboration, the opportunity for this collaboration? If there's any last thoughts you want to share on that?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's, honestly, there's probably enough expertise on either hand to sort of, you know, build on that and just keep the lines of communication open, right? That's what matters the most, right? And that's for the interest of our patients, right? Mm-hmm. So knowing that in a specific area, there's somebody with an interest in dry eye, there's somebody willing to collaborate on, you know, the care of patients before cataract surgery, refractive surgery. And at the same time, you know, among ophthalmologists, there's somebody who may have more of an interest in dry eye, you know, than other areas of ophthalmology. If we keep sort of the lines of communication open and we build on the interest and expertise of one another, I think that's a win-win game.
And one final question on that for you then. How would an optometrist, I mean, of course, we're in BC, so we're going to be a little bit biased to how things work here, but would you encourage optometrists to write or somehow call the ophthalmology office and kind of express that, you know, that interest in that area? You know, what would be the best way for us to connect?
Red optometrists kind of reaching out to my office, to our office, and just to say, I have, you know, I have done fellowship training, or I have done, you know, a specific training in this area. I have acquired this technology. I now fit scleral lenses. I do that. So, you know, making your community around you aware of that. And that, you know, it's something that I would say goes even beyond ophthalmologists, like possibly reaching out to rheumatology, right, or patients that treat with autoimmune diseases, to the refractive surgery clinic, which may not be the same, you know, as an ophthalmology office in a hospital like mine, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, just sort of informing everybody around you that this treatment is there, this option is there. I think that's paramount.
Fantastic. Thank you. I think that's maybe a question that an optometrist would like to the answer to, is like, how do we just call you? Do we just email you? What's the right thing? Because I think sometimes we're a bit tentative about that. We know you're busy, you know, especially someone like yourself has a lot on your plate. But I appreciate you being open to that communication. I think that's really important and much needed, so we can improve that collaboration. So thank you very much, Dr. Iaviano. I got it right this time, didn't I? Dr. Iaviano.
You got it perfect.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. You know, really great insights. I think things that we can all learn from, not just simply in the clinical sense of treating dry eye, but in this important conversation about collaborating and learning how we can all work together. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to be here and to hear and know about your very successful podcast. And thanks for the nice conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Next time we'll talk more about soccer.
We should do one on soccer only. Soccer
just entirely. Soccer. You got it. Yeah. 100%.
There'd be definitely enough material for 45 minutes.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you to everybody who's tuned in, whether you're watching on YouTube, listening on Apple, Spotify, wherever you are. Thanks for taking the time. You know, I'm sure you found Dr. Iaviano's thoughts and insights very valuable. And if you did, again, please share it. Take a screenshot, put it up on Instagram, share it on LinkedIn. Don't forget to leave a review, leave a comment, hit like, do all the good things that help the podcast grow. And of course, I will see you in the next episode. Take care, guys.